Welcome back to Introduction to International Politics. This lecture is about domestic politics, particularly the relationship between the types of governments that states have and the likelihood of them coming into conflict with one another. If you turn to the first slide, I lay out there for you the two goals for this lecture. First, I'll discuss the historic transformation of Western Europe from one of the most violent parts of the globe to one of the most peaceful. From the Napoleonic Wars to the World Wars, to say nothing of the many smaller but still terrible wars in between, Europe has given us most of the worst conflicts in human history. But since World War II, there hasn't been a major war in Europe, only limited conflicts at the periphery. Many believe that domestic politics, namely the triumph of electoral democracy, explains why that is, and why the few conflicts Europe has seen since 1945 took place where they did. We'll take a hard look at this so-called democratic peace, as well as one prominent alternative to it. Second, we'll discuss the interstate peace in sub-Saharan Africa. There's at least two big problems with the fact that most Americans think of Africa as a war-torn continent. One is that Western media rarely reports on economic or political developments in Africa unless they fit a certain narrative, leaving most Americans unaware of the enormous progress many African states have made in recent decades in terms of health outcomes, democratic consolidation, economic growth, etc. The other, which is more relevant to this lecture, is that all the focus on African civil wars blinds us to the rarity of interstate wars between African states. There have been a few, such as the Eritrean-Ethiopian War and the Ugandan-Tanzanian War, and African states have often intervened in one another's civil wars, directly or indirectly, but the sort of traditional interstate war that I sought to help you understand better with Lectures 17 through 21 has rarely been seen in Africa. That's something we need to explain, and I'm going to take you through a theoretical model that I think sheds some light on that puzzle. But first, the democratic peace. That there is a bivariate correlation between the absence of interstate war and the presence of joint democracy, a property exhibited by dyad if and only if both states are democratic, is undisputed. Reasonable people disagree about whether it would be justified to say there's never been a war between two democracies, or whether we should simply say that this is a rare occurrence. But there's no real question that if wars occurred at the same exact rate between pairs of democracies as they do other pairs of states, we'd have seen a few more by now. Not many more, because as I've said many times, war is pretty rare all around, but we would have seen more. It's also worth noting that militarized interstate disputes of all sorts, from those that involve mere threats to use force on up, are rare between pairs of democracies. That's important, though what exactly it tells us is unclear, for reasons I'll discuss later in the lecture. For now, though, just note that the democracies we have at this current moment in history seem to get along with one another really well. The question is whether that's because they're democratic. Some say it is, unsurprisingly. I myself am a skeptic, though, and I'm going to try to convince you that you should be too. I'm going to do that by discussing two common types of causal arguments people have made, pointing out some of the problems associated therewith. These are not the only arguments people have made, nor will I take you through every critique in full detail, but they're the most influential, and the others have problems as well, so it's sufficient for our purposes to focus on a few of the most damning critiques of just these two putative explanations. After I do that, I'll tell you what I think is really driving the correlation between joint democracy and peace. The first argument that implies a causal connection between joint democracy and peace starts from the assumption that leaders of electoral democracies are more likely to be held accountable for their decisions. That seems intuitive enough, right? And if we believe that, some claim, we shouldn't be surprised that democracies don't fight one another, even though they do often fight non-democracies, because when two democracies have a disagreement, the side that's less likely to win will bend over backwards to make concessions so as to avoid war, whereas that's not necessarily the case with non-democracies. Incidentally, it's not obvious that such a conclusion follows from the assumption that democratic leaders are more accountable, especially if we allow for the sort of information problems that I argued in Lecture 21 are probably our best explanation for war. But let's set that aside. There's an even bigger problem with this argument, which we'll discuss soon. The second argument linking joint democracy to peace in a direct causal manner stipulates that democratic societies instill in their citizens a strong sense that it is important, wherever possible, to resolve disagreements peacefully, as well as a deep respect for the right to self-determination. Yes, democracies might go to war with non-democracies, but that's only because non-democracies often seek to deny other people their right to self-determination, and don't share Democrats' commitment to resolving disagreements peacefully. When forces like Nazism, Soviet Communism, or Radical Islam seek to impose their way of life on others, principled democratic states often have no choice but to go to war on behalf of the ideals they espouse. They're never going to need to do that with one another, though, or so the argument goes. Okay, so let's just make sure we're on the same page before moving forward. Europe used to be a very violent place. Since 1945, it's been pretty peaceful. One thing that's changed since then is that electoral democracy has spread across the continent, at least its western portion. Given that almost all European dyads are now jointly democratic, and have been for several decades, it shouldn't surprise us that there hasn't been another big war, according to proponents of the democratic peace. There are, roughly speaking, two variants of this claim. One views democratic leaders as narrowly self-interested and says they can't help but behave differently because they're more likely to get punished for making bad decisions. The other views democratic leaders as committed to lofty principles they learned at home and extend to dealings with the rest of the world, at least where possible. Let's now talk about why we probably shouldn't take either of these arguments too seriously. Turn to the third slide. You see here a table reporting the percentage of Democrats, by which I mean leaders of democratic states, not members of the U.S. political party whose symbol is a donkey, that lost power at the end of a war. The percentage of Democrats who were punished in a more severe way, that is, who not only lost power but were imprisoned, exiled, or executed at the end of a war, and the same statistics for non-democratic leaders. The percentages are broken down by war outcome, measured here in a crude way as either victory or defeat. Finally, the bottom row tells us the difference between the two, which we can think of as a measure of how sensitive a leader's fate is to the outcome of the war. That is, those who are certain to lose power whether they win or lose are in an unenviable position, but if we were to say that they had a big incentive to make sure they avoided defeat and war, we'd be making a strange claim. So we want to focus on how important it is to win. For democratic leaders, it's pretty important, at least in terms of whether they keep their jobs. They're nearly certain to lose power after losing a war. According to this analysis, which is crude and imperfect, that'll happen about 90% of the time. But they only lose power 30% of the time after winning a war. Sure, 30% is a lot, and the fact that their cases were exceptional probably never provided much consolation to Winston Churchill or George Herbert Walker Bush, but 30 ain't 90. Whereas for non-democratic leaders, the difference between the probability of remaining in office after winning versus the probability of remaining in office after losing is about half as big. So that seems to support the key assumption of the accountability-based account of the democratic peace. But look at the differences in terms of punishment. The patterns more or less flip. Granted, war outcomes have a slightly smaller impact on the probability that non-democratic leaders get punished than they do on the probability that Democratic leaders lose power. But that difference isn't big. And, more importantly, we have no good reason to treat those two as equivalent. If you know that losing your job means playing lots of golf, writing memoirs, and painting dogs and/or world leaders, how worried can you really be about that happening? I'm not saying I think leaders of democracies wouldn't prefer to keep their jobs. I'm sure they would. But can we really say that they have no choice but to behave more cautiously than those who know that losing a war is likely to result in their getting shot in the head or being forced to flee the country? Perhaps a better way to say it is, can we really say that non-democratic leaders don't feel any need to avoid bad decisions? If not, it's unclear how we can build an explanation for the democratic peace. If everyone thinks it's important to avoid losing, and everyone exhibits a pretty high level of caution, then war should be rare overall, and again, it is, but it's not clear why it should be any rarer between pairs of democracies than other pairs of states. It's perhaps worth noting here that wars between pairs of autocracies are rare too, particularly those of the same type. Military juntas don't fight military juntas. Personalistic dictatorships don't fight personalistic dictatorships. Theocracies don't fight theocracies, etc. I'm not sure exactly what that tells us, but I do know that there's no prominent explanation for the democratic peace that can account for it. There may be more importance to regime type than I'm ultimately going to suggest at the end of this section, but if there is, we need a more sophisticated argument than anyone is offering at the moment. Okay, turn to the next slide. Here, I lay out some of the reasons why I don't believe that democratic leaders externalize the norms of nonviolence and self-determination that one might argue lie at the core of democratic politics domestically. Sure, the fact that they're willing to go to war to prevent the spread of Nazism or Soviet communism or radical Islam doesn't present much of a problem to this argument. I can buy that those things are reconcilable with the values we're claiming democracies instill in their people. But democratic countries have fought wars of empire. The US did so in the Philippines, the UK in South Africa, several states conspired to put down the Boxer Rebellion in China, and more recently the British and French resisted self-determination movements that sought to put an end to colonialism after World War II, giving us wars in Algeria and Kenya and elsewhere. Those have gotten rarer over time, but before we rush to declare that a victory for the normative account, we have to grapple with the fact that the economics of imperialism have changed. Economic globalization has made it cheaper to rely on trade and foreign direct investment to gain access to natural resources, and there's no need to control a country's government in order to ensure a market for your exports when everyone's pretty open to that in the first place. Second, democratic states have often treated their racial, ethnic, religious, linguistic, political, and sexual minorities pretty abhorrently. And that remains true today, even if great progress has been made. You can't tell me with a straight face that war with another democratic state would be unconscionable to a democratic leader because that would run counter to their deep, abiding respect for all people's right to go their own way, when democratically elected leaders have instituted policies of slavery, segregation, unjustified imprisonment, forced relocation, etc., when Aboriginal peoples have been subjected to what can only be called genocide by democratically elected governments in North America and Oceania, and so forth. Now, that doesn't mean that democracy is anything other than the least bad form of government that mankind has yet devised. I'm not saying you should be ashamed of your country and its form of government if you're the sort of person, like me, who is fortunate enough to have grown up in one of the world's electoral democracies. All I'm trying to say is that a form of government that empowers the average person is not a form of government that ensures the fair treatment of all peoples or the nonviolent resolution of all disagreements or respect for the rights of self-determination. There's still plenty of room there for doing truly awful things to people who are thought of as other, which those living in other countries typically are. I'm willing to make that claim in part because we know that democratic leaders have used violence against other democratically elected leaders at times, but mostly only when they were able to keep it out of the public view. This particular point would be consistent with the accountability claim we just discussed, perhaps, but it's certainly not consistent with the notion that democratic leaders really believe that it's wrong to use force unless you have no choice but to do so in order to protect people from being forced to live under Nazism or Soviet communism or radical Islam. The U.S. orchestrated, or helped orchestrate, the overthrow of several democratically elected leaders during the Cold War, all of whom leaned just a little too far left. Now, in some cases, you could argue that there was a legitimate fear of those leaders taking their countries down the path towards Soviet-style socialist authoritarianism, which is, of course, different from the socialism of Sweden, which is social democracy. And reasonable people have argued, and will continue to argue, about how justifiable such concerns were in some of these cases. But there's at least one that was very clearly motivated by something far less principled: the 1954 Guatemalan coup d'etat. Guatemala had been ruled since 1930 by a brutal dictatorship. In exchange for U.S. support, that government offered huge tracts of land to the U.S.-headquartered United Fruit. A violent revolution occurred, leading to Guatemala's first democratic election. The winner was a leftist who promised to redistribute land, including land held by United Fruit. It's worth noting, however, that he offered to pay United Fruit for that land. He wasn't going to seize it by force, at least initially. And he offered to pay them what they themselves had declared it to be worth in their tax returns. But, of course, United Fruit considered that land to be worth far more than they told the IRS. Their desire to pay lower taxes had led them to deliberately misrepresent the value of the land. So they demanded that Arbenz pay more. He refused. At that point, United Fruit convinced the Eisenhower administration that Arbenz was a problem, and the CIA helped orchestrate his overthrow. Yes, this was the Cold War, and yes, we're talking about a leftist advocating radical redistribution of land, but it's still pretty clear that a major consideration for the U.S. was protecting United Fruit's bottom line. Lest you think that hypocrisy is a relic of the Cold War, consider the People's Mujahideen of Iran, also known as the MEK. This is a leftist revolutionary group that opposes Iran's current government, who have conducted terrorist attacks against Iran and denounced U.S. imperialism and were once allied with Saddam Hussein's regime. Until recently, they were recognized as a terrorist organization by the U.S. and the EU, but that designation was recently removed. Now, some will tell you that's because they've renounced violence, which they have, formally. But so have other groups that are still on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorist organizations, or state sponsors of terror. And I'm sure it's just a coincidence that they've conducted acts of sabotage and targeted violence against Iran's nuclear program and scientists affiliated with that program, with Israeli and probably American help. In other words, the U.S. opposes terrorism, unless it's done by people who hate the right people, in which case we pretend it's not terrorism, and perhaps even support it. Now, that's not the same sort of hypocrisy I was talking about above, but it should make you question the claim that democratic leaders are deeply committed to principles of nonviolence. We could also talk about the fact that the U.S. supports brutal dictators who take the right positions on important international issues, how the U.S. supported some democratic movements during the Arab uprisings while ignoring others, and quietly helped crush the one in Bahrain, bet you didn't hear about that, but by now you're either persuaded or refused to be, so I think we should move on. To sum up, if the reason why there have been so few wars between democracies is that democratic leaders would never even consider going to war with one another, either because it would be career suicide for at least one of them, or would violate the norms we're supposed to think democratic leaders hold dear, then we'd expect to see things we don't see, and we'd expect not to see things we do see. That's a problem. You may or may not wish to take issue with some of the specific claims I've made along the way, which is fine, but if you want to argue that there's something about democracy that is causally responsible for the simple correlation between joint democracy and peace, you need to tell me why autocratic leaders aren't worried about losing wars, and likely their heads, and why we shouldn't be concerned that democratic leaders will set aside their cherished principles again in the future if those principles stand between them and their other interests. You have to tell me why I should believe that India and Pakistan will be less likely to fight another war over the Kashmir if Pakistan ever completes its long and fitful transition towards democracy. Why I should think that an Egyptian government that was more responsive to public opinion would be less likely to set aside the very unpopular 1979 peace treaty with Israel. In short, the arguments people have made stipulating a causal relationship between joint democracy and peace suggest that pairs of democracies should handle their disputes differently than other pairs of states. But as I said at the start of this section, the countries that happen to be democratic at this moment in history don't really have many disputes, so it's hard to evaluate that claim. And the few attempts that have been made do not provide clear support for such a conclusion. There's probably a reason that those countries that happen to be democratic tend not to have many disputes with one another, as I'm about to argue, but it's not obvious that this is indicative of democracy being a force for peace. On the fifth slide, I discuss an alternative explanation for the correlation between joint democracy and peace, one that implies the correlation is spurious, i.e., does not represent a direct causal relationship. This argument concerns territorial disagreements between states. Most wars historically have been fought over territory, and territorial disagreements have been shown to inhibit the development of democracy. When states are fearful of their neighbors, because one of the most dangerous forms of disagreement separates them, it's much easier for a leader to say, "Hey, you need to give me some additional executive authority. Let's temporarily suspend some civil liberties and roll back a few freedoms. I know that's not what you want to hear me say, but I've got to do it in the name of national security." The only problem is they tend not to give those temporary powers back. That's how the Roman Republic became the Roman Empire. In other cases, democracy never takes hold in the first place in order for those freedoms to get rolled back. I'm not arguing that the resolution of territorial disagreements creates an impetus for democracy. It doesn't. There's a lot of debate about where that does come from, but most scholars focus on cultural and economic factors of some sort. What I'm arguing is that states who have territorial disagreements with their neighbors are unlikely to become democratic even if that other stuff is in place. That peaceful, stable, undisputed borders are a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for the flourishing of democracy. And the historical record seems to bear that out. There are very few democracies that have territorial disagreements with their neighbors, and in the vast majority of those cases, resolution of territorial disagreement came first, then democracy. Where there are territorial disagreements between democracies, though, the risk of war seems to remain. Depending on exactly how you measure war and democracy, the probability of a territorial dispute escalating to war does not appear to be any lower for pairs of democracies than other pairs of states. Consider, for example, that Pakistan and India were both democratic, by at least some measures, at the time of the 1999 Kargil War. Pakistan soon turned into a military dictatorship when General Pervez Musharraf got frustrated with the civilian government's handling of that war and seized power. But even so, it was a democratic government in power at the start of the war, and that tells us a lot. If the correlation between joint democracy and peace was mostly causal, we might expect that pairs of democracies would have about the same number of territorial disputes as other pairs of states, but that they'd handle those disputes differently, finding ways to resolve them peacefully more often than other pairs of states do. If you could show me evidence of that, I'd probably renounce my skepticism of the democratic peace. But we have no such evidence, at least not as clear-cut as that of the correlation between joint democracy and peace. Yet we do have evidence that some third factor influences both whether states become democratic in the first place and whether they go to war. That suggests the correlation is mostly spurious. This would be a good time to pause and go over your notes. Make sure you followed everything up to this point and answered the relevant questions on the final. Otherwise, let's move on and discuss the rarity of interstate war in Africa. On the sixth slide, you find a model of simultaneous inter- and intra-state bargaining. There's nothing in the model about where on the globe a country sits, but I hope by the end of the lecture to have convinced you that this model nonetheless helps shed some light on the absence of interstate wars in sub-Saharan Africa. So, as usual, we've got two states, but we're no longer necessarily thinking of them as challenger and defender. Let's just call them A and B. And though we could model the effect of domestic politics in both states, that would make things needlessly complicated, so let's just break one of those two states up into a government and opposition, while leaving the other as unitary. So the government of state A, denoted G, first makes an ultimatum demand to state B, or executes a fait accompli, or whatever. As ever, B can either accept, in which case the international crisis ends peacefully, or reject, which means war. However things go internationally, G then issues a different ultimatum to O, their primary domestic opposition, which might be the military or a rival political party. If O accepts, the domestic portion ends peacefully. If not, we have some form of civil conflict, which could take the form of a civil war, but might simply be a coup. Let's assume that G is uncertain about CB, or the amount of utility that B will lose if they incur the costs of war. That's sort of like assuming they're uncertain about B's resolve, since the loss of utility depends not just on how many people will die, but also how important the issue is. We could assume uncertainty over martial effectiveness again, but this is a little simpler, and now that I've shown you that focusing on uncertainty over martial effectiveness not only gives us an explanation for war, but tells us something about which pairs of states are most likely to go to war, I'm more interested in just keeping things simple. So there's two types of B, one that's blue, and thus better to deal with, and one that's red. Here, the blue type suffers a greater loss of utility than the red type when incurring the costs of war, and so would be willing to make larger concessions to avoid war. The table at the bottom of the slide lays out all the utilities, which are straightforward enough if you followed the logic of previous models. I'll talk through it some all the same, though. Note that when both portions of the game are resolved peacefully, G receives X plus Y, while O receives 1 minus Y, and B receives 1 minus X. That tells you that X represents the share of the internationally disputed good that is enjoyed by the government of A if an agreement is reached with B, while Y represents the share of the domestically disputed good that is enjoyed by the government of A if an agreement is reached with their opposition. I use C's for the loss of utility associated with interstate war, and I've assumed that G and O share the costs when their country goes to war internationally, and K's for the loss of utility associated with intrastate conflict, whether it's a coup or a civil war, and I've differentiated here between the costs borne by G and O. As I've been doing all along, I use W for the outcome of war from the perspective of G instead of C, while gamma does the same for intrastate conflict, again, from G's perspective. The important thing to note here is that there are two versions of gamma. Gamma overline is the share of the domestically disputed good that G will control after an intrastate conflict if that conflict follows a peaceful resolution to the interstate crisis, while gamma underline is the share they will control after an intrastate conflict if an interstate conflict also occurs. Note that I've assumed that B's decision to accept or reject takes place before the second stage of bargaining between G and O, but that doesn't necessarily mean that any war they might fight, if they do fight a war, will necessarily end first. In other words, I've assumed that O is put in a better position vis-a-vis G when G is distracted by a foreign war, or has used up resources fighting a war that's already over. Either way, if G ends up fighting B, then it's not going to be able to make the same sorts of demands of O. That's all you need to know about the setup. So let's turn to slide 7 and get into the analysis of the model. As ever, we start at the end. If the international stage ended in war, O accepts any demand up to and including Y underline, where Y underline is simply gamma underline plus KO. That's just like the X hats and X underlines and X overlines you've seen in previous lectures. If O rejects G's demand, they expect to lose gamma, specifically gamma underline here, and to feel as though they also lost KO. Thus, so long as G doesn't demand more than that, O has no reason to reject. Because conflict is inefficient, and there's no commitment or information problems domestically in this model, G will set Y precisely equal to Y underline, and there will be no intrastate conflict. That is, getting gamma underline plus KO is better than getting gamma underline minus KG, which is what would happen if G demanded more than Y underline, so they won't do that. Similarly, if the international stage ended peacefully, O is expected to tolerate any demand that doesn't require them to give up more than they would if they resorted to conflict instead. But since they do worse in conflicts that follow interstate peace than those that overlap with or follow interstate war, O here accepts anything up to and including Y overline, which is strictly greater than Y underline. Again, that means that G pays a price domestically in terms of putting itself in a weaker position if it goes to war internationally. There are, of course, situations where the opposite might be true, where war unites the country and tamps down criticism of the government, but at least in countries where there's only a weak attachment to national identity, which is true of many sub-Saharan African states, when the government deploys the troops abroad, that means they've got no one around to protect them from a rebellion or a coup. Note that there's never any domestic conflicts in this model. That's obviously unrealistic, but the goal of this model isn't to explain domestic conflict. We'll do that in the next lecture. Rather, I want to use this model to shed some light on geographic variation and the incidence of interstate conflict. I want to address a specific puzzle. Why are there so few interstate wars in sub-Saharan Africa? If I made the model more complicated, it could do more than that, but this is sufficient for our purposes. Turn now to the eighth slide. As you may have already guessed, G faces the same trade-off here that C did in Lecture 21. That is, there are only two demands that make any sense to issue, X underline, which ensures peace but not on the best possible terms, and X overline, which gives G a shot at getting the best possible outcome but introduces some risk of the worst possible outcome, conflict. Unlike in Lecture 21, though, G has to also consider how the outcome of this stage of bargaining influences the next one. That is, if they demand X underline, they know that will be accepted, and that they'll therefore be able to demand Y overline in the domestic portion of the game. If they demand X overline, that might get accepted, in which case they'll still be able to demand Y overline in the next stage, but it might get rejected, and then they'll be forced to settle for Y underline domestically. To figure out what G will do, we take the overall utility of setting X equal to X underline and compare that to the expected utility of setting X equal to X overline, which you see there on the slide. As always, that expected utility takes into account the value of each possible outcome weighted by its probability of occurring. I solved the resulting inequality for phi and created a new phi hat. So in broad strokes, this is just like Lecture 21. The model tells us that G sometimes plays it safe, but sometimes risks war, and they're more likely to risk war, all else equal, when they're more confident that they're dealing with the blue type. They might, however, be willing to risk war even if they were pretty sure they were dealing with the red type, provided that phi hat was low enough. Nothing new here. What's more interesting is that the difference between gamma overline and gamma underline shows up in both the numerator and the denominator of phi hat. That may sound like a bunch of gobbledygook to you, but it has a substantive interpretation. Remember, as I discussed in the algebra refresher, A plus B over C plus B is not the same as A over C. In fact, it's larger, for the same reason that 1 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 is not the same as 1 over 2. In other words, phi hat increases as the difference between the two gammas increases. And since G only risks war when phi exceeds phi hat, that means that war is less likely to occur, all else equal, as the difference between the two gammas increases. So if we could point to some real-world factor that would imply a small difference between the gammas, we've got some leverage on the relative likelihood of war. That brings us to the last slide. The difference between gamma overline and gamma underline at least weakly decreases as gamma overline decreases. That is, the difference between two numbers either shrinks or remains the same when the larger of the two itself gets smaller. In the limit, as gamma overline goes to zero, the difference between the two gammas goes to zero. So the model is telling us that interstate wars are more likely to occur when the government is going to be able to fend off any violent challenge to its rule, be it in the form of a rebellion or a coup, even if it goes to war internationally. In states where there's a real risk of a rebellion or a coup, one that would not be so easily put down, the government really has to think twice about sending the troops abroad, or anywhere outside the capital city in some cases. And those states should involve themselves in interstate wars only under the rarest of circumstances. So if we consider the fact that the risk of rebellion or coup has, in the past few decades, been much higher in sub-Saharan Africa than most of the rest of the world, it starts to make sense that there aren't many interstate wars in sub-Saharan Africa. It's not that Africa's leaders all love each other, or that there are no disagreements between states. There are, and as I said earlier, it's fairly common for African governments to intervene in one another's civil wars, if only indirectly. There are lots of rivalries between governments in Africa. They just don't result in interstate wars, because the domestic political implications of such wars would be unacceptable. Thank you. That concludes this lecture.